Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 1:03 p.m. that is Pacific Standard Time. Today is December 11th. Today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought I would focus this week on commodities and perhaps emerging markets and frame what is looking like a significant transition in the debt markets into what is likely to benefit from that. So I thought this was an interesting chart. It is the futures price for Newcastle coal in Australia, and it trended lower in a very consistent manner off the peak in 2018 and went to a new reaction low this year. And over the course of this quarter, or the last 3 months, it has rebounded in very emphatic fashion. And this is just an example of one of the many different themes that are emerging in the global panoply of the markets right now, because China and Australia are locked in this rather acrimonious dispute, and it doesn't look like there's anything to be gained really in terms of what is going on. And obviously, there is a lot at stake in terms of national pride, but then there is also the big question of the symbiosis between the two economies that's been evident really for the last 20 years. So coal prices are popping on the upside for the simple reason that China isn't really well able to do without the metallurgical coal that Australia exports. But it is putting some constraints on supply. So that is putting it's putting some constraints upon the ability of Australian companies to predict what their businesses are going to look like in future. So for example, Whitehaven Coal is also bouncing, and it had been also trending downwards in a really pronounced manner for the last couple of years. So it is looking really very similar to the outlook for the coal overall. But of course, when we're thinking about metallurgical coal, then it's really all about the steel industry. And China is consuming a lot of resources. And iron ore prices have been popping on the upside. It had a very orderly consolidation in the region of the peak from back in 2019, and then it has really popped on the upside over just the last couple of days to renew its medium-term bull market environment, which has been certainly in a choppy uptrend over the course of the last couple of years, but it is certainly now pushing right back up towards the peaks that we saw in 2012 and 2011. And back then, well, it was the big iron ore producers had been doing really very well for a prolonged period of time. BHP has subsequently, and this was just another factor in the rationalization of the entire mining industry, BHP separated itself into its legacy assets and then its core assets, or I guess non-core and core assets. So BHP Group still has the iron ore, and S32 has got some of the less important minerals. But either way, BHP is coming back into the region of the peaks put in 2011 and 12, and was up in a dynamic manner in here this week. Rio Tinto, which is much more concentrated on perhaps what might be described as the metals of the modern era, is pushing on to new highs in here as well, and is right in the region of the spike peak put in back in 2008. One of the reasons why iron ore prices have been popping on the upside is because Vale's production had been curtailed by accidents, but that share is now also popping on the upside and is really firmed from the region of the trend mean in the last 4 weeks and pushed on to a new 7-year high in here today, but it is way below the peaks put in 2008. A lot of that also has to do with the fact that Brazil has been hit heavily by the collapsing commodity prices over that exact same period. But then, when we think about steel, one of the other big components in steel is nickel, and particularly for the production of stainless steel. So, nickel prices have been in this choppy uptrend for the last 5 years. But of course, nickel is also a major component of batteries. And battery production is likely on a secular bull market theme. So, there was talk by the LME a few years ago that they would create a separate futures contract for a much purer form of nickel. That hasn't really quite yet come to fruition, but it is likely that there is going to be continued demand for nickel sulfide, and that it is going to increase in demand because of that requirement for a purer form of nickel than is specified in the futures contract. And that's perhaps not being reflected in the price of nickel right now. One thing that I thought was interesting to observe over the last week or two has been the rebound in Sherritt International. It's a company that had been trading at $10 in 2011 and close to 10 cents not all that long ago. So a decline of 99.9% is really quite extraordinary. But it has been up in a dynamic manner over the course of the last few months, but most particularly since the election. There is some betting that with a Biden administration, perhaps they will ease some of the sanctions on Cuba. So Cuban-oriented investments seem to be doing somewhat better, and the Hertzfeldt Caribbean Basin Fund has rebounded. Now, that is a similar type pattern to what we've seen in a large number of other emerging markets. But Sherritt International's mine is in Cuba, and one of the reasons why it had such a cataclysmic decline was because of the Trump administration's sanctions on Cuba, and they couldn't export their cobalt or nickel to the USA for Tesla's battery factories. So that resulted in a very significant decline. Now, the one thing I find particularly interesting is that the big spike that we had in cobalt back in 2016 through to the beginning of 2018 has completely petered out, and it is one of the few industrial commodities that has gone nowhere of late. And a good part of the reason for that is because there has been a great deal of substitution. And that is, I think, a significant factor that we do need to remember about big spikes in commodities, that it does encourage substitution and it does encourage new supply into the market. Well, cobalt is a limited supply commodity, so there has been some new supply coming to market, but most particularly that is coming through as a byproduct of nickel mining. So those nickel miners can also help to solve the cobalt shortage in the event that nickel prices continue to rebound. But one thing that has also been quite clear is that the big spike that we had in oil prices in the big commodity boom also was a great example of how high prices are a cure for high prices in the commodity sector, because it encouraged new supply into the market, and we got that from the shale oil sector. We also got substitution in the form of renewable energy. But oil prices now are coming back up into the $50 handle for Brent crude, and this continues to look like a recovery scenario. One thing that we've seen, and it is a pattern common to a large number of instruments, was the spike lower in the first quarter, the short covering rally and reversion back towards the mean, a multi-month period of consolidation, and now in just the last 3 or 4 weeks, we've seen a break higher to new recovery highs. This exact same pattern is evident in a broad swathe of global markets, everywhere from the UK or Europe to Australia and to a large number of the emerging markets as well. And then we also see it here in Brent crude. So they're all pricing in the potential for reflation. And that continues to be by far the most likely scenario, because investors are attuned to the fact that governments are broke and they absolutely need to try and reflate their economies. So when we then think about what some of these factors look like, well, we can think about the private debt as a percentage of GDP. For advanced economies, it's pushing higher, and in emerging markets, it has been trending higher for quite some time already. Government debt as a percentage of GDP has been trending higher in both, but in developed markets, we've been through a period of a fiscal austerity, particularly in Europe, and that's now ending. And then total debt as a percentage of GDP has been trending higher as well. So I think what we can basically conclude is really that there is elevated debt everywhere. And then, of course, when we look at the deficit situation, well, the US deficit is at approximately 15% of GDP. And it's not like it's bounced in any meaningful fashion over the course of the last couple of quarters. In fact, it went to a new low at the second last reading in October and barely bounced in November. This very clear and large deficit represents a very significant problem. So when we start to think about what kind of effect is that going to have on the ability of the government to fund itself, well, we can simply then look at a bond. So let's just think about the on-the-run 10-year treasury. The coupon is currently 0.875%. So right now, the price on that is 99.2635/32nd, and the yield is about 8-9%. Well, if we were to then think about what happens when it goes to 1%, then we get a 1% decline in the price. You can see that the price moves in line in direct comparison to the yield on this calculator. But let's just think about what would happen if the yield went to 2%. Well, a yield move to 2% would represent a 10% decline in the on-the-run bond. Now, if there was the prospect of losing 10% on treasury bonds, which are supposed to represent the absolute basis upon which all other investments are predicated, and that they're supposed to represent the anchor in a portfolio, well, wouldn't the natural proclivity be to just sell them? So yields have been ranging below the 1% level for a while now, and every time they get up towards 1%, they get knocked back down, and the yield is down now to about 89 basis points. But the reality is that governments all over the world are printing, and the US government in particular is running larger deficits and printing more than anyone else. There are lots of different questions about what exactly is likely, and then of course we have the fact that this is not a new problem. There was a clear attempt to try and get inflation moving during the global financial crisis back in 2008. Back then, yields were in the region of about 2-4%, and they have trended downwards since. They ranged between 1.5-3% for most of the last decade. Now they've taken a step lower. And with that, the quantity of debt outstanding has increased substantially. when we think about what kind of impact a 1% move in the yield would have on the price of bonds, then it represents a really incredibly profound challenge for portfolio managers, because portfolios are not designed to take a 10% hit in their core bond holding. They might be able to rationalize that on an isolated piece of a corporate bond holding, and they expect a 10% decline on occasion from the equity portion of their portfolio, but that is also considered to be the most risky part of the portfolio. So then if you think about what kind of knock-on effect that would have in terms of risk and reward, and what it would mean for the highly levered part of the stock market, then it does represent a rather large challenge. So this is, I think, one of the big questions, because we can think about the difference between the 10-year yield and the yield on the S&P 500. And it was at extraordinarily attractive levels back in the first quarter. We had this massive divergence between the yield on equities and the yield on bonds, and it remains attractive. At 75 basis points, you can pick up an additional 75 basis points by owning equities over bonds. So that's still going to represent a very significant tailwind for the global stock market. Now, the bigger question that is probably outstanding is, how long is that situation going to persist? Is there going to be upward pressure on government bond yields, or will we get downward pressure on equities, or will we get both? But this is still trending higher. So we're definitely seeing that equity yields are contracting. The S&P 500 is right in the region of its all-time peak, and the 10-year yield is at relatively static, below 1%. So we've had a significant contraction in the yield available on the S&P 500. And we know that the higher the price goes and the greater the valuation that there is, and when we think about the valuations on the stock market overall, well, the PE is in the order of about 28, and price to sales for the entire index is around 3. So it's quite normal to see valuations expand during a recession. The earnings decline, the price tends to rebound faster. Now, we are definitely seeing more people worrying about bubbly conditions. But this is exactly what you tend to get after a big decline, because it's normal for earnings to lag the recovery in the stock market. But the big question then is, earnings then have to play catch up. And if they don't play catch up, well, then you really are in bubbly conditions. And we're in the situation today where the stock market has recovered, and now investors are, to one extent or another, holding their breath in anticipation of a big reflation trade. And that's basically where we are. So now the question that is arising for most people is, what can we expect from 2021? Well, valuations have increased, and that has priced in a good portion of the recovery. And people will be willing to continue to support the stock market provided earnings recover. Now, what we're seeing in the commodities sector is certainly that there is increasing demand on the global front. When you have this very significant move in coal prices, iron ore, and then I did not show the copper price, but it has also broken higher in a substantial manner, well, then there is certainly the pricing in of the reflation trade going on. It's quite likely that what we are most likely to see is two significant forms of infrastructure development, potentially three. The first is in terms of residential housing. One thing that has been very clear this year has been the strength in lumber prices. And I think this the most important thing is that lumber basically sat out the big bull market in commodities in the mid-2000s. It got up to the upper side of its long-term range, but it didn't really exceed it on a sustained basis. It didn't really break out until about 2018. Then it gave up a lot of that advance, and then it surged higher this year, and it has returned back to those peaks. So this now looks like a step change in the production of, or the cost of production of lumber. Whether that is down to the fact that the mountain pine beetle migration across Canada in the mid-2000s is now contributing to the higher cost of lumber overall, whether one wants to attribute it to that change, well, that is, I think, a logical comparison, since mountain pine beetles hadn't been able to survive in very cold environments for a prolonged period prior to this. So there's definitely been some form of warming in Canada, and that mountain pine beetle infestation has made its way all the way down into the western portion of the USA. In fact, the majority of logging and new supply is coming from the US southeast today, rather than the northwest. And of course, this change in supply is contributing to this advance. But then, of course, we have increasing demand for housing. One thing that I think is particularly interesting is that the dollar value of mortgages has increased to highs not seen, and in fact it has exceeded those seen ahead of the credit crisis. But what is less remarked on is the size of houses has increased and the value of houses has increased. So perhaps we're not seeing an increase in the number of transactions, but it's in the value of transactions where we're seeing new highs. It's quite likely we're going to see a significant building boom. And I do think that this is very similar to what we saw in the 1970s. In the 1960s, there was a great deal of social unrest. There was there was the sexual revolution. There was the social justice revolution. There was the student-led protests, and there was obviously a lot of angst about the conscription into the military to fight in Vietnam. So there were a significant number of themes that were emerging, but one of the most important of those was that there was a very large young population who were demanding a better standard of living overall, and governments panicked. And they responded by building a lot of houses, by central banks monetizing debt. There was a very significant period of debt monetization, and there was a massive building boom in terms of houses. That's how my parents in Ireland got their first house, and they were able to get it on a fixed rate mortgage, which is unheard of today, in Ireland at least. Well, what it clearly helps to highlight is that there was a very sustained period of infrastructure booming in terms of trying to get people off the streets from protesting and into jobs and mortgages in an attempt to civilize them. And it is quite likely we're going to see the same thing on this occasion. So there's likely to be a significant building boom, because the millennial generation, who migrated en masse to the large cities in the aftermath of the credit crisis because they were cheap, are now moving to the suburbs because they are in prime family formation age groups. And that is a sustainable trend because they're a large demographic, and in fact, they are the largest demographic in the USA, and it is likely to represent a very significant trend, and particularly with the evolution of work from home. I personally think that commuting is the greatest waste of human capital one could possibly imagine. So the extra hours that one can have for work or play or for family life by avoiding commuting is certainly beneficial. Of course, the reality for anyone who works from home for a prolonged period is that you don't in fact work from home, but you live at work. So generally, people who work from home tend to work longer hours, or they become more productive and can take on additional work as well. Well, then that is just one portion of the global phenomenon, because China and the amount of leverage that the Chinese government has taken on, particularly among local governments, well, that has contributed to a rather significant a number of land sales in China. So that then is resulting in land sales being to property developers, and property developers then wanting to build. I thought that this was a particularly interesting chart, and it is the China's credit impulse, and it does tend to be rather cyclical, and it's about a 3-year cycle. So now we're coming into the peak, at least the region of the peaks, and if we go out to December 21, Morgan Stanley expect China's credit impulse to hit about minus 4.5 basis points, or percentage points of GDP. Now, if we're thinking about, well, why is the renminbi so strong? Well, that could be a good reason for it, that in macro investors are starting to think that, well, yes, China's renminbi might be overbought in the short term, but it looks like a place where they have not engaged in massive stimulus. There has certainly been a lot of, local governments have had to engage in most of the stimulus, but the central government has not. And if the credit impulse is starting to contract, then that will be beneficial for the currency overall. So there is the clear scope that China's currency is going to do better overall. And if China's currency does well, then it really takes the pressure off of every other emerging market currency. So the Asia dollar index was mildly negative in here today, and it is overbought in the short term, but it has clearly broken its downtrend, and the downtrend has been underway for approximately a decade. But then I think it's also particularly relevant to pay attention to what's going on in terms of the dollar index, because it does also have a clear cycle. It tends to rise for 5 years and fall for 7 years. So it rallied from the low in 1978 all the way up to a peak in 1985. Well, I guess that was a 7-year advance. And then it peaked in 1985 and it trended down. That was a 7-year decline. Then we have either we can take 1992 up to the peak in 2001, but I think arguably we didn't really get an uptrend moving until 1995, so we had approximately a 6-year advance. We had 2002 down to 2008, a 6-year decline. We've had a meaningful move higher from 2011 through to 2016, which was a 5-year advance. We are on or at least we are overdue, perhaps, would probably be the best way of describing it, a multi-year period of dollar weakness. The fundamentals that were helping to support the currency over the course of the last few years are gone. We no longer have a positive interest rate in its favor. The Federal Reserve is no longer reducing the size of its balance sheet, which had the simple effect of reducing the quantity of dollars in circulation. It's really quite the opposite. They have massively expanded the size of the balance sheet and hugely boosted M2. So those are the clear fundamental changes. And then, of course, they are running a deficit of over 15% of GDP. And they have absolutely no plan for how to pay that money back. So it is logical that the dollar should trend lower. So that is obviously then going to be a factor in terms of how investors look at where the best opportunities lie. The potential is that the dollar will weaken, that commodity prices will continue to experience a tailwind as a result of that, that the emerging markets generally have less debt overall. And that is a rather significant factor. When we look at the US deficit, it has been really very profound. When we think about where we're thinking in terms of the overall environment, it is quite likely that there is going to be a significant divergence in terms of growth potential overall. In this year alone, or from 2009 to 2019, average growth rates were certainly being led higher by China, but then also India, the Philippines, Indonesia, and Malaysia. Whereas growth in other markets, particularly some of the commodity producers, was substantially less impressive. I think if we are thinking about commodities doing better and a dollar trending lower, well, then it is logical that some of the commodity producers will also start to grow faster. It would just simply be logical that if there's more demand for their exports and their currencies start to appreciate, that they will see their growth rates pick up. But then, of course, you have the countries that have got the big demographic dividends, and that is most particularly Indonesia, the Philippines, and India. They have masses of young people, and that is the primary driver of outsized growth. There's also a very clear correlation between the declining average age of a population and declining yields. So with places like India and the Philippines and Indonesia with large young populations, it's unlikely that their yields are going to follow the rest of the world down into very depressed levels. We saw that this week the total value of negative yielding debt went to an all-time new low, whereas the Indian 10-year yield is currently around 6%. Now, it has some, I think, potential base formation characteristics, and it would be hard to imagine that we're going to see India move down to negative interest rates, but the rupee is really quite steady, and the stock market is pushing on to new all-time highs. And it was in positive territory again in here today. So I think what we are looking at here is a significant transition. Now, when we think about emerging markets overall, well, the most important thing, I think, is that China is by far the largest of the emerging markets. And it now represents by far the largest weighting within the MSCI Emerging Markets ETF. And that ETF has been going sideways for more than a decade. It, even that one, though, is pushing on the upside. But the challenge is that when we go back and think about the reason why Newcastle Coal is rallying, one thing that we've seen from China is that they are engaging in potshots with politicians through their diplomatic corps, which is very clearly outside of geopolitical norms. It is unusual for various embassies and ambassadors of a country taking potshots at politicians within the country that they're posted. The fact that this wolf warrior way of thinking about enforcing China's view of the world, and then the very active Twitter accounts that they're maintaining internationally, the fact that Tencent effectively censored Australia's Prime Minister, the fact that the ambassador in Australia is posting memes to embarrass Australia in view of the High Commission report on the Australian military targeting civilians in Afghanistan, which is obviously embarrassing, but it wasn't pushed upon Australia by anybody. They came up and did it themselves, which is really a fantastic example of good governance, that Australia was willing to stand up to the stand up in front of the global international community and say that they'd made a mistake, and to hold their service people accountable. That should be celebrated, rather than an attempt made to ridicule the country. And it is a very good example of the fact that China doesn't have a bottom line on what they're willing to do in order to enforce their way of thinking about the global economy. And this is not a favorable trend. So when we think about, well, what is likely in terms of how all of this is going to play out on the geopolitical front? Because we have these very important themes. By far, the biggest and biggest bull market out there is in debt. It's been a bubble, and it's been an evolving bubble for years. So obviously, then, it's easy to identify an evolving bubble. It is much more difficult to identify when it is going to pop. One thing we know is that the debt is evident everywhere, whether it's in terms of the unfunded liabilities and commitments of pensions that are completely unfunded. And then you have the massive deficits in a large number of private pensions as well. Then we have this very inflated asset price environment, particularly in property. And then we have the fact that governments have been writing promises for decades with no real plan as to how to pay. We have aging demographics, particularly in the Western world, which are going to demand very significant proportions of GDP be committed to the healthcare system. Then, if you look at China, they have something approaching 50 million vacant housing units that are simply being held for price appreciation. China doesn't have a property tax, so it's basically free to park money in housing, and Chinese people have a cultural affinity for owning property. So it has been the go-to asset class, in much the same way that bonds are the go-to asset class in Germany and stocks are the go-to asset class in the USA. But the massive asset price inflation we've seen is eventually going to have going to present an issue. When we think about the total amount of debt that is outstanding with a negative yield, well, it's at another historic high, all the way up to 17.14 trillion. When we think about bonds overall, then The two-year yield was pulling down again in here today, and it has now clearly broken the sequence of higher reaction lows. And I need to take the move over the last year has been so incredibly profound that you can't really see the break in the uptrend without taking it away. The 10-year or the 2-year yield is on the cusp of testing the lows from back in May and again in August. So there's no real urgency about inflation before Christmas. But commodity price inflation is already underway. And governments don't have a choice. They have to go for reflation. And that's basically what the stock market has priced in. That's why we've had the recovery in a large number of the companies and the improvement in valuations. There's just no way that governments can tolerate higher interest rates. And then that is occurring against a background of increasing geopolitical tensions. So then we have to think about the reality that no country wants a strong currency. Some need a weaker currency more than others. And then when we think about geopolitical competition, well, it's a lot more expedient to devalue your currency in order to damage your competitor. Therefore, when we look at the strength of the renminbi, it's likely to be volatile. It is likely that we're going to have more back and forth trading. But the general trend will likely be of appreciation. And we're in a phase where all governments everywhere are going to have an issue with debt. And the first countries that devalue their currency and go for outright monetization are likely to gain first mover advantage. So right now, it looks increasingly like it's going to be either the USA or the UK go for outright debt monetization. That's putting downward pressure on the dollar. Then when we look at what is likely to arise as a result of Brexit, well, the pound has been pulling back from the upper side of its range against the dollar in here this week. And then it is right in the region of the lower side of its range versus the euro. I continue to think that some form of deal with the EU is more likely than not. I just don't believe that politicians have the stomach for the kinds of sacrifices that will be made to really put the UK back on a very competitive environment relative to the EU in particular. And the EU doesn't really have an incentive to allow the UK to compete aggressively against it. So that does suggest that there will be an accommodation, but it's probably going to be very limited in nature. And there is likely to be both some give and take between the two parties. Against that background, the UK is trading at low valuations. Now, quite whether it is going to have the wherewithal to be able to come up with a new growth strategy is rather questionable, when it may have to make concessions to the EU in order to retain access to its biggest trading partner on a favorable basis. But if we do come out of this period of negotiation with some kind of deal, I would anticipate that the pound can rebound in a substantial manner. Then that would throw the most likely scenario being that the UK will not be the country that first moves into a period of debt monetization, but rather it will be the USA, and That is why we have this weakness in the US dollar. Now, if we start to play forward what all that means, if we are moving truly into a period of financial repression, then the reality is that the USA or anywhere else will not be able to tolerate higher interest rates or higher bond yields. And we could be in a moving towards a period of yield curve control, which is effectively managing both the long and short ends of the curve. And if we get that, then one of the easiest ways to hedge exposure to that eventuality is gold. And gold prices are right in the region of their trend mean. We had some steadying action in here today, but it's going to have to do better than that and sustain a move back above $1,950 in order to clearly demonstrate that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. I just find it difficult to believe that gold will move very much lower on any kind of sustained basis against a background where every government in the world has a clear intention to devalue their currencies. That is also one of the primary reasons why Bitcoin remains reasonably steady. It is now consolidating in the region of the previous peak. It has been off its lows for 3 days in a row. So one thing that we know about Bitcoin is that it does tend to have an accelerated timeline in terms of consolidations, pullbacks, and action overall. The kinds of moves that might take 6 months to roll out in a normal stock or commodity tend to happen in weeks in the cryptocurrency markets. So one does have to be prepared for exaggerated short-term moves. This, for so far at least, doesn't look like much more than a consolidation in the region of the peak. When we think about Ethereum, which I would regard as high beta Bitcoin, then it is pausing in the region of the 600 level, but again, so far it has not looked like much more than a consolidation within a broader bull market environment, which is effectively a set of ranges this year, one above another. One of the primary reasons investors are expressing an interest in Bitcoin is that they are looking for a hedge against the worst proclivities of governments to devalue their currencies. That is also the reason why people are interested in gold. Gold has very clear physical attributes and is not easy to walk away with large quantities of. Bitcoin can be moved with ease in size across international borders. That is obviously a clear benefit for anyone trying to move their money around the world, but of course it is also open to being stolen. So there are, I think, positive attributes and negatives to any hedge asset class, but they both have unique attributes that will make them attractive to various different parties. If we are moving into a period of at least yield curve control or potentially fixed yields, then the reality is it will set off a mania for hedges against inflation. We're really only at the beginning of this phenomenon. But one thing that we can also pay attention to is that agricultural commodity prices are rising. So there is already a significant drought in Latin America, and that is likely to have a significant impact on agricultural commodities right across the region. One thing that I found rather interesting is that potash prices have been rising over the last few months, and that's coming from really very depressed levels. When we look at wheat prices just this week, they were up 3% in here today. But the bigger picture here is that it is looking increasingly likely that the base formation is in the process of being completed. And this week is looking like a large upside Weekly key reversal from the region of the trend mean and the upper side of the base formation. It's about as clear a technical signal as anyone might wish for. And the reality is that agricultural commodity prices have been depressed for a long time, and wheat prices have had this rounding characteristic, which is consistent with accumulation for years now. Soybeans is consolidating in the region of the 2016 peak and has rallied rather impressively this year. Corn prices have also got these clear base formation characteristics and is pushing up on a seasonal basis back up towards its peaks over the last 6 years. Obviously, the pandemic has had a knock-on effect for the global agricultural supply chain. Then we have changing weather patterns in terms of the transition from El Niño to La Niña. And then we have the potential for increasing demand because of the supply chain disruptions. Then when we think about the pressures on farmers, well, low prices mean that they don't have the money for fertilizers and have to go out and borrow it. Mosaic, for example, has a very similar trajectory overall to the agriculture futures sub-index. And of course, futures sub-indices, they incorporate the contango costs. So when it does, in fact, trend higher, it's usually because it has a backwardation at a tailwind, but also a prolonged period of demand dominance. And the agricultural sub-index has clearly broken its downtrend. So we are back in a bull market environment overall for commodities. Oil prices are recovering, copper is recovering, lumber, the industrial resources and agricultural commodities are all doing better, and the unweighted index is back in the region of the upper side of what is a 5-year base formation. So we have got the building blocks for commodity price inflation. We already have asset price inflation, and this brewing geopolitical discontent, particularly between the USA and China, is potentially then also going to create goods price inflation. I think the Asian region is likely to benefit more than anywhere else from the spat between China and the USA, because both powers will be attempting to encourage cooperation from third parties, and it is Asian countries will be able to play one off against the other and benefit accordingly. It does mean, though, that investing in emerging markets will be very much dictated by individual country performance, and that is particularly true of the fact that China is a very significant weight in the majority of emerging markets. Now, then we should also think about what is likely in terms of the best performing asset class over the last decade. Because the NASDAQ has done spectacularly well, and it did even more, or it did even better, in the stay-at-home period. So we had this really phenomenal acceleration all the way up to the peak earlier this year. And subsequently, we've seen some loss of momentum. One thing that's particularly relevant is that the largest share in the index is not at a new high. Facebook, which had been among the best performers from the perspective of the social media sector, is not at a new high. And in fact, it has this wedging characteristic over the course of the last few weeks, or months, I should say. And that is suggestive of stops being raised, offers being lowered, supply and demand back in balance. And there is the potential that we could have a significant decline in the event that there is a bearish catalyst in the form of a real concrete attempt to try and break it up. So we're definitely seeing rotation. We're seeing rotation out of the previous high flyers and into the second order potential beneficiaries. So Snap, for example, has taken up the baton and is now outperforming in the social media sector. Twitter is coming up to the upper side of what is a 6-year range. In fact, if you count 2014, it's more like a 7-year range. When we look at Disney's extremely impressive breakout in here this week, well, that has to be counted against the rather high valuation and slowing growth of Netflix, which is just about holding on around this $500 level at present. What is quite likely is that at the very minimum, we're going to see a rotation out of the most highly leveraged companies and into those that have got growth potential or stronger balance sheets to back them up. Then, when we think about the rotation overall, it's likely to be into the commodity sector, into real assets, into the industrial sector, which will benefit from global reflation, and also from the potential for greater geopolitical conflict. And then, of course, we have the potential for money to flow out of heavily indebted developed markets and into emerging markets. And the catalyst for that change is the downtrend in the dollar. The dollar is primed for at least a 5 to 7 year decline, which would really support the view that we're going to have a significant bull market in commodities and emerging markets all the way through until the mid-2020s at least. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.